You say you did it. I say you didn't. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. You say you worked hard. I say so did I. I say you got lucky. You say I didn't try. So you say it all worked. I say not for me. You say I didn't try. I say you just don't see why. You say I didn't try. I ask, can't you cry? You ask, why should I? I ask as I sigh. Why can't you see it? If we exist as I, too few will make it if we are only I. Folks, that's the whole question in life is how much do we care about others and how much do we sacrifice a little bit to make our world a better place? We're going to talk about all kinds of issues on this show. This is Lehigh Valley Discourse and WDIY, and I'm your host, Alan Jennings.
Brian Nestor may well be the person in the Lehigh Valley who has the greatest impact on the most people. If you own a company, Brian will have something to do with one of your greatest cost centers. If you ever get sick, his decisions are likely to determine how quickly you recover or even whether you'll recover. If you're poor, he'll have a lot to say about whether you get access to care. It is entirely likely that you or someone you love works for him. Brian Nestor is a doctor. An ER doctor, an emergency room doctor. But he isn't just any doctor. The operation he runs has a $3 billion budget. It's the largest employer in the Lehigh Valley. If you stood anywhere in the Lehigh Valley and swung a dead cat by its tail, you'd most certainly hit one of his offices. Brian Nestor is the CEO of Lehigh Valley Health Network. And I have him in the humble studios on Bethlehem's south side of WDIY for the next 55 minutes or so. Brian, welcome.
Thanks very much, Alan.
I'm your host. I'm Alan Jennings. I've been doing this for a little while. I have a lot of fun doing it. I get to come in here and hang out with Neil Heaver, who's over there making sure everything works properly. And Neil, we can't thank you enough for all you've done to make public radio happen in Lehigh Valley. In my life, I work for the Community Action Committee of Lehigh Valley. That's not important, except that it does provide a little bit of context. And I'm looking forward for some time to the opportunity to talk to Brian Nestor and have the smartest listeners in Lehigh Valley listen in. So, Brian, let's start with the Affordable Care Act. It's clearly the most consequential legislation in decades, I think, for health care. Is it good or bad for Americans' health?
It's a great question, Alan. I think it we can do some Monday quarterbacking on that, and but maybe first go back to that era. When the ACA was signed in March of 2010, and there was a lot of activity about healthcare after the 2008 election. We, as a group of hospitals in America, were watching with bated breath to see what might happen. Certainly, the ACA, I was not personally a fan of the Affordable Care Act at that time. I would say, though, that as we read through the 2,000 pages and found 20 pages around value-based reimbursement, they kind of had us at hello. Value in healthcare is defined as value equals quality divided by cost, and producing higher quality at a lower cost we see as our job. So we really like the tenets of the ACA related to value production.
So it makes prevention a much more important part of the equation, right?
Absolutely.
You know, let me give you, I mean, despite Affordable Care Act, which has been obviously such a you know, curveball, I mean, lots of guys can hit curveballs, let's call it a knuckleball, you still are excelling in a number of different ways. Personally, I think bragging is good therapy. I mean, I don't understand why we're not allowed to do that. So, and since you're not the only person in that operation that made it possible for you to have all the stuff to brag about, I think it's fair to put aside humility for a minute and take a minute or two and just brag a bit about what you guys are doing over there. Because we've got tougher issues to cover, but I think it's you deserve the opportunity.
Well, that's very kind of you, Alan. And we are a community organization, not-for-profit, that helps deliver great care to our citizenry, but we do it with the help of a lot of community organizations, no doubt. But, you know, I have had actually a 30-year association with Lehigh Valley Health Network. I've been here for, this is my 21st year in the Lehigh Valley. But
you,
I had
you understand you're not one of us until you're here for 30 years, right?
That's right. But I do have a wife who was actually born in Bethlehem, so
okay,
I
well,
feel
we'll
as though by association I'm allowed to be here.
Okay.
So, but you know, I had the opportunity as an emergency medicine resident in Philadelphia to get exported to the Lehigh Valley to see what blunt trauma was all about. And that was back in the late 80s, early 90s, and I came up and fell in love with Lehigh Valley Health Network. At that time, it was the busiest on-scene helicopter system and blunt trauma system in the state of Pennsylvania. And so, you know, I love the clinical care, extraordinary providers, foundation of nursing unsurpassed, and always wanted to come back and had that opportunity finally in 1998 to come back to Muhlenberg. If you fast forward 30 years and start thinking about what you're most proud of, you have to look at what's changed. So back in the 1980s, early 90s, blunt trauma was the number one mechanism of injury, and largely around automobile accidents. Mm. Instead, today, our number one mechanism of injury, do you know what it might be, Alan? I'll tell you.
Opioids?
Tell you.
No.
No, not opioids, but a big problem, certainly, is fall from standing position. It is really around the elderly, fragile seniors.
I would imagine Parkinson's doesn't help.
Absolutely. All movement disorders, right. Things like that, and just to getting older. People are falling. A lot of them are on blood thinners, and they have major trauma. So I reflect on that only to say that we've have an organization that is constantly iterating. It is trying to adapt to whatever the population is that requires the most attention. And clearly in Pennsylvania, we are maybe the fourth grayest state in America, roughly. Certainly eastern Pennsylvania is no exception to that. We expect a 62% increase in Medicare eligibles in just Lehigh and Northampton County between 2012, 2030, and we're already exceeding that. So
what
I'm most
proud. 60?
Yeah, 62% just in those two counties. And, you know, so the point is, I'm most proud of the organization because we're adapting. We're trying to look and see who needs the most care, who needs what kind of care, how do we identify those people early and give them what they need.
So funding is the challenge. You know, there's all kinds of data out there that we spend more per capita per, you know, on health care. We don't have the kind of outcomes in Scandinavia, for example, is the with you know consistently the healthiest people, and so you know trying to figure out how we you know generate the resources to extend care to more people. The rallying cry on the left these days is that Medicare should be available to all Americans. Would that make matters better or worse? Medicare's got its issues too.
Sure. I think there's a lot of confusion probably around what that actually means. If it's truly defined as Medicare, the current program for all, it frankly is untenable. It's not practical from a financial standpoint. Most American hospitals lose money in the net on most of their Medicare populations. And certainly Medicaid is more challenging in terms of necessary payment to deliver services. And when I don't think we're much different than most of our peer organizations, you know, roughly 7 out of 10 people that walk in any of our doors are Medicare or Medicaid or uninsured. So, you know, Medicare for all, hey, I think that if it were feasible, it'd be a great idea. It's just not. I think probably what I would like to see is have basic coverage of some type for every American, no doubt. And that probably is separate and distinct from what the funding mechanism would be to hospitals and providers.
Medicare for all is really just, you know how politics works. It's pretty much just, as I see it, a crafty way of pitching a single-payer universal health care program, like frankly every other modern industrial democracy in the world has. Mm-hmm. If our system was taxpayer funded, mm-hmm. would it free up massive costs to most employers? I mean, I've never really understood in the first place why access to health care is an employer's responsibility. I've never understood that. If you don't have a job, what are you supposed to do?
Right.
You know, lots of people don't have jobs. Children, unemployed people, obviously, poor people, seniors. The whole notion of employer-sponsored health care doesn't make any sense to me. So if I'm an employer, I think I would want health care to be available for everybody through a taxpayer-funded system, essentially, you know, a single-payer universal health care system. And yet employers have not stood up, and some have. I mean, you've got Richard Master at MCS Industries and people like Chris Martin, who, you know, very good people, good friends of mine. Does it make sense for health care to be funded by employers as opposed to having it in the tax, you know, base for everybody to share the cost of paying for it? Because I think what happens is employers compete by seeing who's better at denying health care to their employees because it's such a huge cost center for the employer.
If it could ultimately, health care could be completely funded by a taxpayer, hey, that would be great. Again, I think it's that ship has sailed. I just don't know how it would be possible.
Because you don't think it's politically possible, or you don't think you think it would crush the economy? I mean, why?
Yeah, I think it'd have unbelievable economic effects. The cost, keep in mind, just to expand Medicaid is an enormous cost. And which I think is a good program. I think people having some kind of basic coverage, call it Medicaid or medical assistance, is terrific. Keep in mind, we get the opportunity then to take care of more patients that have truly less ability to pay. But it's better than being uninsured. The reality is when people have some level of coverage, I believe they get engaged in their care. And that's the holy grail of care. Having a patient actually say, I guess I will fill that prescription for insulin, is remarkable. It changes their life. It's a good thing. So having basic coverage would be great. I don't think it can be. There's so much cost in healthcare today. To be completely taxpayer funded would be very challenging. So it's been shifted, no doubt, over to the employers. The challenge is that the real challenge we're facing right now is there is not the payers got regulated in the Affordable Care Act. Okay, they have a medical loss ratio dictum of 85% of every dollar goes to clinical care. So it's kind of put a cap on their administrative gains and or their surplus at the end of the year. We used to, as a provider system in our industry, use the winnings from commercial insurance to make up for the offset the losses on the government side.
Right.
That's no longer a strategy. So how you could actually flip this around to taxpayer, fully taxpayer fund, I have no idea.
So I'm assuming you're part of a hospital trade association.
Mm-hmm.
What is the trade association for the? What's the big 800-pound gorilla in the trade association for hospitals?
Mm-hmm. American Hospital Association.
And do they have an official position on? I mean, is what you just said the
yes.
party lines, so to speak,
yes.
or is that? Does the rest of this, where are they?
Actually, just last week, the American Hospital Association put out a statement on a position statement on Medicare for All, which was in the net opposed to Medicare for All, and really outlining some of the challenges that would make that really just untenable.
You still make rounds. I mean, this guy runs a $3 billion operation, and he's making rounds. And the most amazing thing about it is he makes his rounds not in a unit at the hospital. He makes his rounds on the streets of Allentown. Brian, you know, I mean, that's pretty heroic. And I don't think you do it because it's a PR gesture, because I don't think anybody knows it except maybe the listeners that just found out. What's up with that?
Well, you know, I love those experiences, number one. And in some ways, as an emergency physician, I kind of that experience reminds me of how much I don't know and how much I didn't know. I would proudly, as would my wife, who's also an ER doc by training, we would proudly say when we were in Philadelphia, these are our people, drug addicts, the homeless, the impoverished, people that just needed a break and from the cold. We loved caring for those vulnerable people. The thing that embarrasses me a bit is that even as an ER doc, caring for folks like that for a couple decades, I still had no idea what happened after they left. I moved on to the next patient. Having the opportunity to build a street medicine program at Lehigh Valley Health Network.
You have a full-time person who does this stuff.
We have... many full-time people that do this. Yes, we are built. In fact, yesterday we just made additional investments in full-time equivalent employees to join that group. You know, for me going out there, it reminds me that the problem doesn't end when I discharge them from the emergency department. That problem is a societal issue. It's out there live every day. I would tell you, I was recently out with Tom Harrington, Tim Fallon, two local execs, and we walked out to a place I hadn't been to in about 4 years, and it is 10 times worse. That camp is 10 times worse than where I was at. In the prior 4 years, I had probably met only about 3 women out on the street total. I met 5 that morning. Homelessness is a major problem. It's a societal issue. It's every community's dirty little secret, and it's a reminder that we have to do better. And it can't just be about hospital care or doctor office care. We have to take care of the community.
You know, historically, women are not showing, don't show up as single individuals in the system like men do, in part because women, I hate to say it, but women have, it's easier for women to find a place to sleep if you get the code language there. Plus, they tend to have kids with them, and so they need to be in family shelters. We've always felt that we shouldn't have, you know, the traditional kind of homeless individual mixing with moms and kids. Mm-hmm. So they tend to be, you know, specialize in one or the other. You know, the numbers, it would be interesting to find out what it is that's driving women's numbers going up the way they have. Mm-hmm. But so are there lessons there that you've taken? I mean, mm-hmm. What?
Yeah, I think there's a number of lessons for me. And frankly, that experience actually helped shape our strategy. As we started this hour, thinking back about the Affordable Care Act, value-based care. We're hooked on that. We like that idea. But when you really start to uncover how is it possible to deliver higher quality care at a lower cost, you start to struggle. You start to say, well, who can we stop giving care to? Well, nobody. And who are the people that are really high cost? The reality is, and we've done a lot of analysis on these populations, the highest cost individuals we care for are normally distributed. All right. So it isn't like there's a group of people that we can say, oh, these are high cost people. Let's just take care of them. They're normally distributed across the population. Mm-hmm. The challenge is finding the people that actually are not engaged in their care. And we've concluded that those people are what I refer to as vulnerable citizens. All right. These are socially isolated, financially fragile seniors. They are the impoverished and socioeconomically obstructed in our community. They might be medical assistants or have no insurance whatsoever. And sadly, also veterans in our own community. When you start to concentrate your efforts on vulnerable people, you start to identify that there's a lot of waste in the system with care that's being provided way too late. You know, in the ER, we say we'd rather take off your toe than the leg. The reality is, when you get delayed care, and it's not preventative care, all right, and you don't have access to health insurance, even medical assistance, you tend to put it off, and we see you at such a late stage that the amount of care is enormous. The cost of that care is enormous. So finding people vulnerable earlier is the kind of thing you need to do to reduce cost, and that's what our entire strategy is about.
You're listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. I've got Brian Nestor in the studio with me, so if you think that you're hearing somebody that sounds particularly smart, this guy's a doc, and he runs a $3 billion corporation, and I'm impressed as hell by this guy. I've had him in my class, and he's blown me away with his business argument for taking care of people who are the poorest among us and the most expensive healthcare consumers, if you want to use that word. We're now talking about his experience providing care to people who are homeless, which I consider heroic. And the hospital has invested a lot more money in these things. And this matters to every one of us because we all really pay for the system in one form or another. And when it doesn't work, it doesn't work. It costs everybody. We're at the break time, amazingly, already, and so we're going to take a quick break. I hope you'll stick around, and we're going to talk some more with Brian Nestor, CEO of Lehigh Valley Health Network, largest employer in the Lehigh Valley. Pretty interesting guy. Stick around.
Not only is becoming a WDIY member a great way to support the programs you love, it has its benefits. WDIY members have access to our weekly member ticket giveaway emails, discover great concerts, theater performances, film screenings, and more, all while supporting the many choices and real voices on WDIY. Make your gift today at 610-694-8100 extension 7 or WDIY.org. Thank you.
Welcome back. Glad you're with us. I've got Brian Nestor, CEO of Lehigh Valley Health Network, in the studio here at WDIY. And I could interview this guy for like days. I don't know if anybody would want to hear it for that long, but
I'm sure nobody, Alan.
Lehigh Valley Health Network is an amazing operation. It is a massive operation. I run a $25 million nonprofit, and I got 100 employees. And it's a challenge. I can't even imagine how you communicate with all the people and all the sites you have. We could get into a whole long series of questions about management that would be interesting to have. But we're talking healthcare now, we're talking about homelessness. That gets us into the kind of hip issue of our time in healthcare. That is. Which is population health. The topic is, arguably the hottest in the healthcare industry these days, outside of perhaps how we pay for it. Brian has been, as I mentioned, very generous with his time talking to my class at Lehigh University. And I've sat there and listened in awe as you've explained how the hospital serves the least of these. Talk about what is population health and what the heck are you doing about it?
Great. Thanks a lot, Alan. First of all, we're fully vested in population health. It's actually part of it's our core strategy as it relates even to our business strategy. Mm-hmm. But maybe a couple anecdotes of what got us there. So population health, very different than public health. All right. Population health is a science that really tries to understand the segmentation of your citizenry and understand what their unique challenges and problems are. So if you're in an acute care hospital, you tend to be focusing on who's sickest at the moment. Mm-hmm. All right. And honestly,
triage.
Yeah, triage. And we've I'm very proud of our efforts. We are often ranked in the top decile of the Vizient database for mortality rates. So we do a lot of good things. There's no doubt about it. The reality is that sick care is only one small portion of the care that people need throughout their life, all right, to remain well. And when you really start looking at the business problem that was really kind of put forth with the Affordable Care Act, that A, you need to take care of more people, American hospitals, okay? You need to provide them a better experience. We're going to pay you less, and what we do pay you, we're going to withhold and give you a little bit of it back depending on if you hit certain quality metrics, all right? And in case you think we're kidding, we're going to sequester 2% of your revenue this year.
Man.
So take care of more people, give them better care, and do it at a lower cost. That's the dictum. Frankly, I think it's a good direction. I think our industry has been a bit lazy over the last 40 years, unlike other industries that have gone through similar kind of tectonic events like the transportation industry, logistics, certainly, mm-hmm. And many other industries. So as we looked at it, we say, look, we're going to take care of more people and get paid less. What's the opportunity? So we started looking at patients and seeing who can we give better care at a lower cost and really kept getting tangled up. In the final conclusion, think about a cancer case. When someone comes in with a stage 3 breast cancer, you're going to wind up getting a lumpectomy, axillary dissection, sentinel node biopsy, radical mastectomy, a bunch of other treatment. It's millions of dollars over 5 years, and hopefully a survival. But right now, for example, breast cancer is nearly 90 to 100% curable. Okay,
yeah,
it is remarkable if you catch it early,
it
stage
yeah.
1. So what we learned is it's not can you modify or give the best treatment or reduce variation in how the care is provided. It's none of that. It's going further upstream, identifying the women that need to get their mammogram, identifying the disease earlier, and the treatment, guess what? Lumpectomy in stage 1, All right. Negative sentinel node biopsy, no need for additional surgery, and a potentially a pill for a cure. Now, which one's higher? Potentially a cure. Now, which one is higher quality care at a lower cost? So, I mean, when you look at that in a fee-for-service world, and I have a hard time saying fee-for-service without saying perverse fee-for-service, because fee-for-service, you know, is kind of like hamster wheel transactionalism. It's getting paid for doing as many things to as many people, as many seconds of every day that you can see patients. The reality is that's a terrible way to manage a population. So what we've decided is let's go in and find the people that are at rising risk for bad things to happen to them, okay? Snatch them, be on top of their case, give them additional resources if needed to try and give them a better outcome and keep them out of the hospital. Now, in today's economy and healthcare, that is like burning stacks of money, okay? Because we get paid to deliver that care. But the reality is when you look at who's driving most of the cost that is making many hospitals today insolvent, it is government pay patients, Medicare, Medicaid, where there's just insufficient payment to take care of them. They tend to also be the people that are most vulnerable and not accessing care early enough. So we've shifted all of our focus over to finding vulnerable people. Last year, we have a very mature population health program now. Last year, we made 113,000 phone calls to 20,000 people. You know, we serve hundreds of thousands of people, but we've identified really at-risk people, and we try to chase them down and give them better care.
So, as I understand it, there is, I mean, the biggest chunk of uncompensated care is going to a fairly small sliver of the population, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you're shifting more of the resources to get them mm-hmm. preemptively mm-hmm. rather than very expensively yeah. post, right?
Yeah, it's great. That's exactly right. And here's why that math works. As we look over the last 20 years, and we look at, for example, 990s, where we have to report in that.
That's an IRS tax form that nonprofits have to file, just for folks that
yes,
don't know what
that is.
Yes,
thank you very much. And the technical term is patient direct care shortfall. It often gets summarized into community benefit, okay? Mm-hmm. But it's an economic, quantitative economic analysis. And what we've seen is that our community benefit or patient direct care shortfall, that's like free care. It involves subsidies that we put to give better care. Flu drives. By the way, flu drives, it certainly is not driving this past year $500+ million in community benefit that we've calculated. Mm-hmm. The biggest chunk of that, probably close to 2/3 of that, is actually insufficient payment from Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries. So as we look at that, that number's been doubling every 3 to 4 years for the last 16 to 20 years. Mm-hmm. That amount of money we found is the new bank, because there's no new money coming from the government. There's no new money coming from the insurers. Where the money is in inefficient care being delivered to very vulnerable people. So let me give you an example. So as an ER doc, one of the most common things that would happen on Monday morning is you could almost set your watch by it. Two or three patients would come in congestive heart failure, people in their 80s. Call one, an 85-year-old Edna, who has chronic congestive dilated cardiomyopathy. She's on Lasix. She has... lives in a 6th-floor apartment building, has a walker, can't
drive.
Nobody's
paying attention to her.
No one's paying attention. Her best friend.
She's taking her meds.
You got it.
Paying her rent.
Her kids call each week, but one's in Indiana, one's in Illinois. She relies on the people in the apartment building to check on her, but her best friend is Meals on Wheels. Those are the people who are stopping in 3 days a week to give her entire social outlet. Problem is that if she runs out of her Lasix, her water pill, okay, and or she runs out of quality food to eat, she'll go to the cupboard, she'll pull out Campbell's chicken noodle soup, no offense to Campbell's, but it's 2,000 milligrams of sodium probably, all right? Yeah. And she gains 4 pounds over the week and goes into congestive heart failure, shows up in an ambulance. We intubate her, put her on a ventilator, put her in the ICU, take the extra fluid off, discharge her in 3 or 4 days, and the cycle repeats. This is like rinse, repeat, because we're not proactive enough with these people. It's a great resident case. There's lots of critical care that gets delivered. But for her, what a terrible life. So those are the kind of people we reach out to. How do we make sure she gets her scripts filled? How do we make sure she gets her appointment to her doctor? How do we make sure that we reach out and check in on her? How's your weight doing? We might even put her, she might be one of 400 people we have on a remote monitor that actually weighs her every day and mm-hmm. sends data into our center in Lehigh Street. That's the kind of stuff we want to keep her out of the hospital and healthy.
You know, four of my favorite words in the English language that are strung together is "I told you so," but it's really arrogant saying "I told you so." But I think you know, I've been bugging the system for years to recognize that if you just hold their hands a little bit, you know, make sure they're paying the rent, make sure their heat is on and their furnace is working and they're taking their meds, we'd save a ton of money and everybody would be better off. And what's amazing is that you found a business argument for that, mm-hmm. Which is what makes you a social entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. It's what I teach at Lehigh. And really the main difference between a social entrepreneur and a regular entrepreneur is motive. Obviously, when you're in healthcare, your motive is to provide care. And, you're spot on this thing, Brian, and I appreciate your leadership on it. Before you took over as CEO of the hospital, you or not the hospital, but the network, you were a C-suite guy leading the hospital's strategic direction. First of all, is your strategic plan a public document, or is that a is that a private document or a public document? If I called and asked you for a copy of a strategic plan, would you give it to me?
I don't know why we wouldn't give it to you. There are some competitive things in there that we'd like to redact. but otherwise, we're actually very vocal about our strategy for caring for patients, which is tied to our economic strategy. But I don't think we post it online, and I don't know that we'd give you the entire document, but we'd certainly share what our strategy is.
So are there 5 big ideas, 3 big ideas, no big ideas? Can you share just a little bit of it?
Sure. Yeah.
Just off the top of your head?
I think there's 2 major components to it. One we've kind of talked about already.
Population health.
And population health. But the words we use there, and it is not sexy when it comes to a business plan or a business proposition, but we refer to it as lose less. We're going to try and lose less on vulnerable populations because that's the bank of money. It's inefficient, squandered dollars in healthcare. I actually refer to them as dirty fee-for-service dollars. We don't want to get paid to have someone be put on the ventilator because we weren't proactive enough to make sure she had her medicine over the weekend. So that's one side. Let's lose less. Let's really focus in on providing high-value care to those who are most vulnerable because that's where we're going to save money. That's a real opportunity. The other is that we really need to do a better job at our customer experience, patient experience. How can we actually have people think of Lehigh Valley Health Network as someone who will be there, a partner in your care, as opposed to just a big place with scary medicine and where, you know, big surgeries are performed? We want to be part of the community. That's really what we want to be.
I guess that gets us into behavioral health. It's right there in the population health thing. I mean, if you pull off some miracle on somebody, you send them home and they go back to their apartment and shoot up heroin, mm-hmm. Obviously your value-based care thing is going to get shot. I've long believed that our behavioral health system in Lehigh Valley is terribly inadequate. Mm-hmm. And I think the... community health needs assessment that hospitals are required to do every 4 or 5 years?
3-year cycles.
3 years? You have to do that every 3 years? Man. Has said that behavioral health care is clearly one of the mm-hmm. top problems. What are you guys doing on that issue in particular? You know, by behavioral health, obviously, I'm talking about mental illness, sure. and drug and alcohol addiction.
Yeah, right. So if you believe in pop health, and you believe in trying to combat the socio and economic challenges that push people from the bubble, you know, into despair, then you kind of it's unavoidable to make investments in behavioral health and mental illness care. No doubt about it. I would say that it's probably, and I agree with you, Alan, and I've learned a lot from you in this regard as well. Behavioral health, we know as an industry, is an independent risk factor, okay, for bad outcomes, all right? Bad outcomes of all kinds, whether they're economic or medical. So if we were to pull a behavioral health flag, for example, just a diagnosis code for anxiety alone, all right, I would tell you that alone is an independent risk factor. It might as well be hypertension. okay? It can have that much of a negative impact on the individual's health, their ability to survive in the community, and their impact on their family. So what are we doing? I'm probably the thing that I am most proud of in my 21-year official association with LBHN is our work in behavioral health. I go back to running the emergency department at Muhlenberg in 1998. It was around.
You have a unit.
Yes. Right. A very interesting story.
Is it
then.
The only? No, Sacred Heart has one too, right? But Easton Hospital has gotten out of the business, haven't they?
I can't answer that about Easton. But, you know, it was very interesting for probably well before I came in the early 90s. We had a leader in psychiatry, Dr. Michael Kaufman, also our CEO, Dr. Elliot Sussman, together really supported behavioral health initiatives in the community. And I had never seen. I came from Philadelphia, where we had an acute psychiatric hospital at Albert Einstein, where I trained. I was very familiar with those assets, and I was surprised at the assets that were here. Early 2000, we built a building, which is not called a psychiatric hospital. It's called a behavioral health and science center. But it's really roughly a 70-bed psychiatric facility where we admit a lot of patients. When we made the decision to aggregate all of our psychiatric beds onto one campus at Muhlenberg, I would tell you it was a great opportunity for a number of organizations and communities to shut their services down. And I would tell you, running the emergency department, we would see in a very busy 30,000 patient year emergency department, we'd see about 40 mentally ill or patients with a behavioral health diagnosis each month. The month we opened that up, it was October of that year, we went from 40 to 240. It was a crisis. Wow. That was my first awareness. And by the way, we filled the place up in 2 days. Okay. That's when I really realized, my goodness, there, even with these efforts and these investments, there's not remotely enough behavioral health resource in the community. We've been on that journey ever since. I would tell you, in the last 18 months, our new chairman, who took over for Dr. Kaufman, Dr. Ed Norris, has recruited 19 new psychiatrists and advanced practice clinicians just in an 18-month period. We're making continuous investments in that space.
Aren't we short a number of psychiatrists that are, you know, what the standard for psychiatrists per population are?
Absolutely. We absolutely are.
And I mean, there's no pipeline to fix that, right? I mean,
no.
Nobody's going into psychiatrics.
Well, we've developed a psychiatric residency program where, if you look at the statistics, I recently heard 60% of residents that train at a facility will stay in that community. So we're very hopeful that we'll be able to mint our own psychiatrists and have them stay in our community. And that's a good thing, but it's not even, it's rounding error in terms of the number of psychiatrists you could have in the community or could use in the community. That said, you can't let that be the end. So we are developing all sorts of new jobs, behavioral health related jobs that can extend access to psychiatric care in the community. We have very robust, forget the hospital, the psychiatric hospital component. We have very robust ambulatory services, partial programs for patients that have challenges with mental illness. So we're investing in the outpatient space. We have a very aggressive telepsychiatry program, so we can get access to a master's prepared social worker in behavioral health 24/7 from a single site at all of our campuses. Those are the kind of things that you need to do to extend those services, and even with those investments. And there are other community investments from other organizations trying to help here. It's insufficient for the Lehigh Valley. And sadly, I think we're better off than many other communities.
Yeah.
But this is a big problem. You're totally right.
You're listening to Lehigh Valley Discourse on WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. I'm your host, Alan Jennings. More importantly, my guest is Brian Nestor. He is the guy who runs the biggest employer in Lehigh Valley, the biggest healthcare system. His daily decisions have an impact on almost all of our lives. We're going to take another quick break. Hope you'll stick around. We got Brian Nestor on the backside. Thank you.
Celtic Fair, a celebration of Celtic music and culture, from its roots in Ireland, Scotland, Wales, Brittany, and Galicia, to its branches in Australia, Cape Breton, Canada, Chicago, New York, Philadelphia, and the Lehigh Valley. Music, interviews, and a weekly culture calendar, every Thursday from 7 to 9, here on WDIY.
Welcome back. Glad to have you. You're listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley Public Radio, Many Choices, Real Voices. This is Lehigh Valley Discourses. I'm Alan Jennings. I get to be your host once a month. I have a ton of fun doing this. It's always fascinating interviewing the remarkable people in Lehigh Valley, one of whom is Brian Nestor, the CEO of Lehigh Valley Health Network. We were talking about behavioral health. And you know, this is another kind of catchphrase in the industry these days, which is the social determinants of health. I would say they're economic determinants of health more than anything else, because so much of the world's problems revolve around the inability to afford whatever, your rent, therapy, care, and so on. What are the social determinants of health?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you, Alan. I would say to our conversation about street medicine, this is another discovery for me personally. Somewhat even embarrassed that we hadn't embraced the opportunity to further explore social determinants of health earlier in how we approach delivery of care in the community. I've learned personally a lot about it in my association with you, Alan. I think you're absolutely spot on in terms of the challenges vulnerable patients in our community have. Actually, it's helped us say the following, that the health of the overall community is only as good as the least healthy segment of our community. That's a catchphrase we are serious about.
Love it when people in control of vast resources say things like that.
Yeah. Well,
I was going to say, I bet you say that to all the guys.
We have it on our walls. We're committed to that. Now, just because we say it doesn't mean we're expert at it. We realize that we can't fix all these problems, social determinants. So, for example, do you have someone that cares about you, whether that's a spouse or a family, or maybe it's a neighborhood community, a synagogue, mosque, or church? Do you feel safe in the space that you live, or are you a victim of domestic abuse? Do you have options to have healthy food or access to healthy food, or are you making bad choices? Are you making good personal choices for your own behavior is another social determinant of health as well. And ultimately, I think the economy is a huge part of this. Do you have sufficient wage, all right, to get access to the services, access to health care, and be able to provide a safe house and shelter for your family and your dependents? All of those are, and there are other social determinants, certainly. But as we start looking at that as a health network, what's our role? Well, certainly, we are going to double down and refocus on vulnerable populations, making certain we provide the best possible care we can to them before they get really sick. Or if they are really sick, give them a better outcome to keep them out of the hospital and out of expensive care, number one. But we also realize that having being the largest employer in the community, we have a real voice and a real opportunity here to make certain that we share that with our own colleagues and make sure that they share it with their neighbors. What can we do with our own volunteer time? What can we do to try and work with other community organizations? And probably the most important part is, what kind of conversations can we convene with community organizations, or whether it's public or private funders, that we can start to aggregate our resources together to fix problems? Now, this is a conundrum. You've been living this for your entire career, Alan. But, you know, the continuum of thinking about a person that's on the street living under a blue tarp, and just in terms of homelessness, and going to, on the other extreme, you know, the real affordability of housing in our community as yet another problem. There are miles between those two. And there are opportunities working together to try and keep people from going into a homeless situation. We've recently, and these are live conversations, I was at a meeting where we were reviewing the housing stock in the community, seeing that 9,000 units in the greater Allentown area, the people that live in those units are spending over 30% of their income just to have a roof over their head. And some of those roofs are not good roofs.
Well, we have people who are spending 70% of their income on housing. I mean, it is crazy out there. It's been a crisis so long, I decided to stop calling it a crisis and start calling it a disaster. The good news is people like you are paying attention to it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think this community's got a lot of good human assets to solve its problems. And you're certainly at the top of that heap. You mentioned employment, and I wanted to ask you, you know, you're the biggest employer in Lehigh Valley. Is there, you know, a soothsayer? That, I mean, there's got to be a verb form of soothsayer. Is it say sooth? But as you would say sooth, what does the future of employment in the healthcare field look like? I mean, are there things that you shouldn't go for, you should go for?
Mm-hmm.
What is it?
Yeah, I think that there is, everyone talks about a physician shortage. It's probably a provider shortage. Now that we have physicians, we have nurse practitioners, we have physician assistants, and numerous other licensed professionals. I think there's an opportunity to leverage technology. One example of that is electronic medical records. We've made an IT investment of over $1 billion in a 10-year period to roll out electronic medical records. But here's the value of this. I used to talk to docs and about trying to improve some dimension of care with some payer at the time and say, hey, how was your day? Oh, it was brutal. You know, at 6:30 at night, I'm talking to you. I should be at a soccer game. I'm missing it again. So 25 people today, still have 3 hours of paperwork to do. You know, that's not a healthy view of the world. Yeah. By the way, in America, 56% of docs are considered to be burned out. Mm-hmm. We are no exception in this community. That said, I think there's an opportunity when I would ask him, hey, or her, hey, did you see the right patients? They'd say, of course I did. And the reality is, they can't, after they get done talking about the top three patients they remembered, they can't remember the other 20. It's because we're really not being efficient and effective in who we're seeing. Remember, going back to our conversation about Pop Health, if you have a panel of 4,000 patients and you have the analytics to tell you who's at rising risk for something bad to happen with a pretest probability of admission to the hospital in the next 6 weeks, wouldn't you want to spend time on that patient instead of necessarily Brian Nestor, who's in for yet another visit around his blood pressure and weight management? So you really want to be, I think we can leverage technology to allow our licensed professionals to use their cognitive skill set in a much more efficient way. I think that will create new roles and new jobs for people, medical assistants, tech partners, administrative partners, other community health workers, and people that can be out giving face-to-face, hand-to-hand treatment that doesn't require a doctor. And I like that because what we've learned in Pop Health is it's people caring for people. Rarely is it some sophisticated surgical intervention that requires a physician. It's often just someone offering to help that gets the patient engaged.
Yeah, I was listening for that three-word community health workers. That is a key to the whole population health thing. You know, back when Obama's economic stimulus bill was passed, we got a bunch of extra money to you know, sort through some of the problems and try to respond. And Pool Health Care Trust came to us and said, what we really should be doing is we should be funding and training community health workers. And, you know, I thought that was cool stuff, but it turns out that was good additional soothsaying. Mm-hmm. Because we are now, I mean, how many do you have? You've got dozens, don't you?
I don't know if it's dozens. I know that in the category of pure community health workers, it's probably about a dozen. But I think there are individuals that we call something slightly different than that, mm-hmm. that are care coordinators, that even lean into case and care management, where we're probably over 100. So they're all working together as a team and have slightly different job descriptions. I can tell you that's radically different than when I got here 20 years ago. And that's a good evolution to have more providers, the face-to-face providers, not being a doctor. Doctor's a choke point most of the time, trying to get in the office. So having other providers that can give the direct kind of care the patient needs, which oftentimes is not medical. Sometimes it's more behavioral, social, the other factors
cultural.
We've talked about.
Cultural. You know, just offhandedly, there are a bunch of people in the Lehigh Valley who have pretty wicked ADHD issues. Tony Iannelli, I think would be the first to confess he's one of them. Phil Mittman, former mayor of Easton, I've got a wicked problem with ADHD. I'm pretty sure you should be a member of that club. I think you should maybe even be the freaking chairman of the club. So just on a personal level, how do you relax? Do you ever get to relax?
Because I sure. Know, yeah, no, just to, for me, it's, you know, family, friends, spending time together. It's not as often as maybe we'd like, but I'll be honest with you. I'm kind of addicted to solving the problems. I love these challenges. Healthcare is a tough place. There's no doubt about it. And even internally, in dark moments, we'll even say to each other in the executive suite, hey, it's going to get worse before it gets worse. but once you kind of say that, boy, we are really up against it in healthcare. And by the way, our industry deserves to be up against it. We haven't been as responsible as we should have been. I can tell you we're very proud that this year, for the first year, and our budget for next year is the same. Our cost per adjusted case is below the prior year. And we're doing our best there. But honestly, I love talking about, my relaxing time is actually talking about the problems, reading about the problems, trying to come up with better solutions.
People like us are, that's kind of weird, you know? I'm with you, Dan. I feel the same way. Our generation, I mean, because I think you and I are in the same ballpark in terms of age. Our generation has sort of grown up with marijuana, if you will. Has our generation hoodwinked our society into buying the health advantages of cannabis so that, you know, we can bust out our bongs that have been in hiding for 30 years? Mm-hmm. Or is there a real medicinal benefit here? I every day I read this stuff, and I can't believe that we're talking about marijuana today the way we are, given, you know, what I experienced back in the 1970s as a high school troublemaker, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'm certainly no expert in this space. I would say, though, that in our investigation, and we have experts in this area at Lehigh Valley Health Network, that we do believe that there are some benefits. All right, I can't quantify that for you. Enough that it's worthy of discovery in some cases and research.
Beyond placebo?
Yeah, beyond placebo, yes. And I think for that reason, we've invested in further exploration of those. We'll participate in research if appropriate. But to the degree to which it's become an economic factor across the country seems a bit disproportionate. So I think your maybe little cynical view of this is not unreasonable to consider. Again, it has not been a major priority for our network.
What keeps you up at night? I cannot imagine running a $3 billion corporation. How many employees do you have?
Mm-hmm. Just over 18,000.
18,000 freaking people. What keeps you up at night?
Honestly, straight out, it's financially fragile seniors. Every night. I think that wave of boomers that we've talked about, which will crescendo over the next decade, 2020 to 2030, really, really scares me. And here's why. Here's a good example. My father, my grandfather, Leon Lester Nestor, no kidding. Lester Nestor, yeah. Twin sister Esther Nestor, swear to God. From Virginville, swear to God. Yeah, he passed away of a heart attack at age 62, like he was supposed to, actuarially, right? The problem is just one generation, my dad, Larry, same risk factors, just passed away a year ago at age 84, 22 years extra. So grandkids born, had a great life. But when he died with three active cancers. He had just finished his fourth round of radiation for a squamous cell carcinoma. He was on probably 8 different medications, and that's down from 20 because he has a son that was a doctor to try and simplify things.
Wow.
But he still played beanbag baseball at the nursing home with his friends and my mom. So what a good life. There is not enough money in this universe to take care of 10,000 new Medicare beneficiaries living longer, women, average age, 80 now plus, men 75 plus, living with an average of 4 major comorbidities on multiple medicines. There's not enough money to take care of them. That worries me, and it really worries me when they are people that have fragmented family structure and they don't have someone there to help them. They're living alone. They're socially isolated. It's not good for them. It's not good for our society. That worries me a lot.
You have played a pretty significant role as an anchor tenant in downtown Allentown.
Mm-hmm.
You occupy a substantial chunk of the arena. I didn't even realize the elevator went up to there's a ninth floor. Is that the top floor?
Yes.
I know J.B. Reilly. You know, he's a friend of both of ours, and he's a longtime Lehigh Valley Health Network partisan. has been very supportive. I think he's a former chair of the board.
Yes.
He obviously did something really impressive with the pediatric program.
Yes.
At the hospital. Did you move into the NIS because of a desire to help that process come along? Did you do it because it was a clear business, bottom line benefit to the organization, or other reasons?
A combination of things. It certainly, the NIS created an economic opportunity for us to consolidate services somewhere down there. Number one, but we didn't have immediate need at that moment. We could consolidate things strategically if we felt there was a strategic reason to be there. That's where the strategy kind of came in. We really wanted to be. As we started thinking, keep in mind, this was only a few years ago, and we've talked about Pop Health, we've talked about our role in the community. We know that, for example, just down the street from where our office is there at 700 Hamilton is St. Paul's Church. St. Paul's Church was ground zero for a century for the homeless population in the Lehigh Valley. We would start our rounds at St. Paul's Church. So being down there, being part of this unbelievable opportunity to create a renaissance that most of all would spill over and favorably impact, frankly, the blight and despair of the adjacent and surrounding communities, why would we not want to be a central part of that? And I think it was really the biggest driving force to be part of that commitment, and we're very happy that we did.
I'm happy that you did, too, because you're putting feet on the street, that those people are buying stuff at the local retail establishments and helping to build the tax base for the city and many other things. So I'm glad that you're there. I think cities are critically important for the vitality of a region. If you don't have a healthy city, that causes sprawl, and before you know it, the environment is tanking because of it. Mm-hmm. So I think you've contributed to the quality of life in our community significantly just by your location. Yeah. in the NIS.
Well, we're happy to be part of it. There are a number of big employers, private company leaders down there. We meet regularly and talk about how we now have to fulfill the mission. And the mission is not just to have a vibrant development and real estate development downtown. It is to make certain that it can extend and improve the lives of people in the neighboring communities. We are still invested in, and there will be more. And I'm actually very proud to be one of the represent Lehigh Valley Health Network as one of the organizations that are doing great work downtown. We have so many. Again, LVHN is just a part of this puzzle. We work with great organizations like your organization, Alan, Valley Youth House, Council of Churches, so many vibrant organizations, criminal justice system, the legislators downtown. I've never in my history here, and again, it's only two decades, been more optimistic that we can actually transform and take care of some of the really tough issues downtown in Allentown, and hopefully spread those throughout the other communities that we serve at Lehigh Valley in more rural markets even.
We've run out of time. Thanks for sticking with us, and hopefully you'll check in with us my next show in another month. You've been listening to WDIY, Lehigh Valley Discourse. I'm the host, Alan Jennings. My guest has been Brian Nestor, CEO of Lehigh Valley Health Network.